Life is a journey, not a destination. That's a statement that is attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson, a 19th century American philosopher and poet. Now, those aren't his exact words, but what he wrote was something very similar, and that's the phrase that is attributed to him and that has become pretty well known. Life is a journey, not a destination. It's intended to be a meaningful and profound statement. After all, Emerson is a philosopher as well as a poet. Now, what it seems to mean, as I consider it, is that as we deal with the twists and the turns of life, we're always searching to find our way. And nobody else can really tell you what your purpose in life is. You have to figure that out for yourself along the way. I've seen inspirational posters that illustrate a similar point of view. One of them that I noticed not too long ago was a picture of an attractive young woman walking into the sunset. And the caption below the photo says, "Life is a journey, and only you have the map." That thought gives, I suppose, a sense of empowerment. Your life is yours, and how you live it is your choice, and no one can tell you what to do with your life. It's the idea that you're totally independent to choose your own ultimate destination. It seems kind of appealing, maybe even exciting. And if you read Genesis 3, it might sound kind of familiar. Now, maybe there's some truth in a way to that statement, because we all deal with many life-changing decisions that we are responsible for and no one else can make for us. But really, is life simply a journey and the only destination is whatever you choose? I might put it this way. What's the point of a journey if you aren't going someplace? Or maybe I could ask it another way. If you don't know where you're going, how will you know when you get there? Now, when I was in high school, I got my first car. And I used to drive back when I was 16, 17 years old. I would drive just for the sake of driving. I didn't need any place to go. I just wanted to drive my car. It was a beat-up old Pontiac. And thinking back on it, I think I should have been embarrassed to be seen in it. But I just did not care. When I was driving, I would intentionally take the longest route. And sometimes along the way, I would get off that route and kind of wander around and explore just to be driving. When we went someplace as a family, my father would often let me drive. He'd say, "Son, I am sick of driving. You go right ahead." And I think to myself, how could you ever be sick of driving? I couldn't get enough of it. Well, 50 years and about a million miles later, and I mean both of those numbers literally, I understand what Dad was saying, and I agree. Driving can be very tedious. Life is a journey, and sometimes that journey is, in fact, most of the time, our journey is enjoyable. Really, we have mostly good experiences, and we look forward to many more good experiences as we consider the future. Life is always challenging, but hopefully it's also fulfilling, even though there are difficult times. But if life is only a journey and not a destination, that means there's no purpose for your existence except to experience life. And when it's over, when this life is finished, you haven't arrived anywhere. Or Maybe along the way you picked your own destination. But either way, when life is over, if that's your point of view, then that's it. It's over. So today I want to consider and in fact take issue with that particular philosophy. The title of the sermon today is Life is a Journey to a Destination. And that's one of the basic lessons of the annual Holy Days. It's a lesson that I think we can emphasize as we approach the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. God has given us life, and that life has a purpose, or in other words, a destination. Let's begin by looking at a couple of verses that are very familiar to us. Let's go to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew, the 7th chapter, and we'll read verse 13 and 14. Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Here, as he begins to come near the end of what we call the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives this instruction. He says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." Before I make any comments, let's also look at Luke's account of this statement in Luke chapter 13, verse 24. Luke chapter 13, verse 24. Luke records it this way. Jesus said to them, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able." Now, I think we all realize that in biblical times, many of the cities were walled. And they had gates in the wall that would be used to enter and exit the city. They were constructed in this manner primarily for security purposes. If they were attacked by a neighboring city, they could limit access by closing the gates and keeping the invaders out, or at least keeping them at bay. The main entry, or the main gate, would be on a wide public road. One of the commentaries that I was reviewing said that the gateway used by the public as the main entry and exit point was usually about 16 cubits in width, which would be roughly 24 feet, about 24 feet wide. Now, just to make a comparison, in the United States, the standard width for a travel lane on a highway is 12 feet. Go out here to Oak Spring Road, got two lanes. One each direction, each lane would be 12 feet wide. Total, 24 feet. So that gives you some kind of an idea of how wide the entrance would be to the city at the main gate. Now, in our case, we add another 3 or 4 feet on each side for a shoulder. So it's more like 30 feet from shoulder to shoulder. But at least it gives, again, some kind of an idea of how wide it would be for one to enter a city at the main gate. Be plenty of room for lots of pedestrian and cart and donkey traffic going in and out of the city. Very easy access and easy to use. You could carry pretty much whatever you needed to in or out of the city very easily. But there also were smaller private entrances that were built into the wall of a city. A private entrance was typically about 4 cubits wide, which would be about 6 feet. The smaller private entrance would be about what my wingspan is. I'm 6 foot tall, so be about this wide to get into the city through one of the smaller entrances. And these were private. They were somewhat hidden. not easy to find, and not as easy to negotiate. 6 feet is not a big entrance. You know, even a grocery store aisle is wider than that. You're not going to get very many people or very much cargo through that kind of an entrance. So the analogy, the spiritual lesson we draw from this is pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy to see. There's a way of life that most people choose without giving much thought because it's obvious and it's the easy choice and it's where everyone else is. It's wide enough that you can do pretty much whatever you need at that entrance and without any confinement or difficulty. But there's another choice that's hard to find. It's narrow. It's confining. It's a choice that most people would not make because it's just not convenient. It's not easy. And in fact, as we saw in Luke's statement, you have to strive to enter that gate. You have to work hard, first of all, to find it, and then to gain access to it and to choose that way. And it's compared, of course, to a way of life that's more difficult, more challenging. But you know, both gates lead to a destination. The wide path leads to destruction, and the narrow path leads to life. Given that choice, most people would prefer the path that leads to life, but not many can find it. And even if they did, not many would actually choose the way that is more difficult and more confining. Sometimes from our perspective, we look at maybe the choices other people have made and we think, well, that would have been easy. I mean, they have the easy life. They have the easy way. They can do whatever they want. They can live as they please. But remember that even people who choose what seems to be the easier path find that the journey of life is difficult and can be very hazardous. Travel conditions are often treacherous and dangerous. There are potholes, black ice, construction zones, and detours, even on the wide and open routes. So they have their troubles if they choose what seems to be the easier way. But what's most important is that this wider, broader, easier-to-find path leads to destruction. And the narrower path arrives at the destination of life. Life is a journey. There is a destination at the conclusion, at the end. As we continue into the spring holy days this year, it's obvious that the path that we have chosen, the path that we are traveling, can be narrow and it can be extremely difficult. We know that many of our brethren are experiencing serious trials and carrying heavy burdens. Yet as we observe these days, we should be reminded of the hope that God gives to us in them, and we should be encouraged that we know what our destination is. We are on a journey that God is leading, and a journey that will take us toward the ultimate destination of life. One thing kind of as a side I'll mention, it's not really the main point that I wanted to address today, but I think it's important for us to be careful not to associate God's way of life only with trials and difficulties and pain and sorrow. We know that we experience those, and life can sometimes be very, very difficult and very challenging. But God's way of life is a positive way. It is the best way to live. It is the way that leads to the destination that we want to arrive at. And it is the way that we will fully enjoy. We should be thankful to God for the life that He's given to us and not overly obsessed or bothered by the difficulties that we find along the way. I pointed this out before as well, and I think it's important to remember, too, that we not associate this particular time of year just with trials and difficulties. I think we all might observe that, you know what, it seems like just before the Passover and unleavened bread, problems seem to spring up, and we have a lot of difficulty. Don't deny that that might be the case. But I think it's important that we also not only associate this time of year with difficult times. Because this time of year is a time to rejoice in our calling. This time of year is a time to recognize and to thank God for His saving power that has rescued us. And to be thankful that God Himself is leading us on a journey. The Sabbath and the annual holy days help us to be reminded of that journey. The Sabbath and the annual holy days map out for us the path that leads to life. And by observing these days, we're reminded to stay on that path, to continue on the way and in the way that God is leading us. Each one of us will have our specifics that are part of our journey, our unique circumstances, our trials and challenges. And we make choices along the way. And it can be a challenge to us. We're going to talk a little bit about why and how God brings that into our lives. But the holy days remind us that life is a journey to a destination. So we're going to draw a parallel, I'm sure it's a familiar one, between our experience and the experience that Israel had as they came out of Egypt. The days of unleavened bread remind us that just as God rescued Israel and took them on a journey to their destination, which was Canaan, the promised land, God also has rescued us and leading us on our journey through life so that we will ultimately reach our destination, which is His kingdom. So as we compare these two experiences, we'll see what we learn from Israel's experience. The first point that I want to emphasize as we begin to consider this is that God did not lead Israel directly to their destination. God didn't lead Israel directly to their destination. Their journey, the journey in which God led them, took them the long way around. He led them into the wilderness, and He led them there for an important reason. That is, that there were things they needed to learn before they would be ready to enter the promised land. There were some things they needed to learn before they'd be ready to enter the promised land. Now, remember when they left Egypt? They left with a high hand. It was a night of celebration, and we'll celebrate that ourselves in a few weeks. It was a time of when they felt completely victorious. As they marched out of Egypt, you know what? They didn't have a clue where they were going. They didn't know what was going to happen next. All they knew was they were out of there. And that's why they were so excited. But there was more to it than just being out of there. God wanted them to learn a few things to be prepared to be in the promised land. The distance from northern Egypt, the area of Goshen, to the promised land is just a little over 6,300 miles. Actually, that's the distance from northern Egypt to a small community in South Carolina called Promised Land. The Promised Land that God was leading Israel to was north and of Egypt and slightly to the east. And the shortest route between Goshen in northern Egypt and Canaan was about 250 miles. About 250 miles to the northeast. This was where God had promised Abraham his descendants would be brought and would be a great nation. To get there is an easy trip, actually, along a very heavily traveled main road called the Way of the Philistines. It had that name because it went through the land of the Philistines. That's 250 miles. That's a pretty good hike. It's the same distance, by the way, as it is from Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. So picture yourself heading out next on March the 30th, that Friday night, walking to Washington, D.C. Well, it didn't work that way anyway, because God led them along a different route entirely. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus chapter 13. We'll read verses 17 and 18. Exodus 13, verse 17. It came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. God led them, frankly, in the wrong direction. Instead of going northeast, they were going south. They were headed into the desert. And that's exactly why Pharaoh was so convinced that these people don't even know where they're going, so he was going to track them down and try to take them back into captivity. So right away, we can anticipate that God is not going to lead us directly to his kingdom along the easiest and most obvious path. And there's a good reason for that. As far as the Israelites are concerned, we saw here he was protecting them from the Philistines, who would have attacked them as they entered the Philistine territory. God was protecting them. But you know what? They never knew that God protected them from that because it never happened. He knew that his people were not ready to deal with the Philistines. Frankly, they never were. They were a pain in the neck of the Israelites throughout their history. But God knew that they were not ready to face and deal with the Philistines. There were plenty of issues and challenges that were on the route that God had chosen them for them, but they never knew what they didn't experience. They didn't walk into the Philistine territory. And even as he was leading them on a difficult path, he led them away from that particular difficulty and challenge. So when we think about how God leads us in our lives, there are times when we wonder, don't we, about the twists and the turns that are taken. And we wonder and sometimes ask God, why? Why this? Why now? Why me? We wonder why God is dealing with this in the way that he does. But one thing we ought to remember, though, as we ask those questions about our situation, we don't know what didn't happen. We don't know those areas that God has led us away from that we never had to experience. We have plenty of challenges, plenty of issues, plenty of difficulties, and when we feel hurt, we wonder why God allows those things to happen. But even as he brings us or allows us to be in certain circumstances, he is protecting us from others. And we realize, or should consider, that he has protected us from things that never happened as he's leading us along the way. As God was leading his people Israel, I've already mentioned this, but emphasize it again. The reason God led them in the way and on the path that he did was to teach Israel how to be his nation. To teach Israel how to be his nation. And just as God was teaching Israel how to be his people, God is leading us along our path of life to teach us lessons that we need to learn to be God's children. Things we need to learn before we get to our destination. After God finished off Pharaoh's army in the Red Sea, Israel proceeded along their path into the wilderness instead of taking a direct route to Canaan. You know, a direct route from Egypt to Canaan would have taken about, I would say, at most, even with traveling as they were, 3 million people with all their children and the older people and the flocks and so on, they probably could have covered that distance in about 3 months. That wouldn't be traveling any more than, say, 3 or 4 miles a day. And since it was a main thoroughfare, along the way, there probably would have been water. There would have been places to get some food. It wasn't like they were going to take an exit and catch a McDonald's drive-through, but there would have been some civilization along the way. They wouldn't have been out in the middle of nowhere all by themselves. It still would have been difficult, but at least it would have been the broad path that would have been easier to choose and the one that most people would travel to make that trip. But instead, he leads them into the wilderness where they encountered immediately a need for water and then for food. And they were homesick. They were confused. This wasn't what they had hoped it would be. It was much more difficult. And that's not because God was being arbitrary or because he didn't care about what they were going through, but he was, again, working with them to establish them as his nation and preparing them to be his people living in the land of Canaan. Let's notice a couple of benchmarks very quickly here. Exodus chapter 40. Exodus chapter 40, verse 17. Exodus chapter 40, verse 17. It says, "It came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up." As the second year was beginning, in the first month of that year, on the first day, the tabernacle was completed. So this was almost exactly then 1 year after they left Egypt. Already a whole year has passed since they left Egypt. They spent most of that time camped at the foot of Mount Sinai. And during that year, much happened. It was a very eventful year as God was shaping and forming them to become his nation. Let's just quickly an overview here of what we find in the book of Exodus to consider what they'd learned, or what they'd experienced at least, during this time. First of all, immediately after they left Egypt, God had to provide water for them in the desert. He did that in chapter 15, and there was another miracle when he provided water for them in chapter 17. God also provided manna within those first few weeks, which continued as their source of food for some 40 years. That's in chapter 16. In chapter 16, God also taught them about the Sabbath, about use manna as a means to teach them how to prepare for and how to keep the Sabbath. In chapter 19 and 20, we see that God entered into a covenant with his people. He promised that they as a nation and as a people would prosper if they would be faithful and obedient to him. That covenant is summarized in chapters 20 through 24. Then, after establishing the covenant, God gave them directions to build a tabernacle. The tabernacle was very important because it was evidence that God would dwell with them, that their God would be right there with them. That's what the tabernacle was for, to draw them to God and to show that he was with them, a very significant development. But again, shortly after God had established his covenant and told them, given them instructions for the tabernacle, Israel turned back and worshipped a golden calf. They returned to idolatry almost immediately after they entered into their covenant with God. They broke that covenant. They returned to the worship of an idol and gave that image credit for having brought them out of Egypt. How incredibly insulting that was to God. They were punished severely, and God nearly left them all to die on the spot there in the wilderness, but was willing, because of Moses' intercession for them, to continue. So then they built the tabernacle, and that construction took most of a year. And that tabernacle remained as the primary place of worship for God's nation for almost 500 years. When Solomon completed the temple in 957 BC. And in this time frame as well, we find at the end of chapter 40 in Exodus that God promised to lead them by the cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night. So this was a time of education for the people of Israel, a time when God was beginning to work with them and to establish who he was and what he expected of them. It was a very eventful year. Now let's make another comparison. We saw in Exodus 40, verse 17, that this was the first month of the second year, on the first day of that month. Compare that to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. I'm sorry, chapter 10, verse 11. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. It says here that it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year. So this is now going ahead just a little more than a month from the time when the book of Exodus ended. We're in the 20th day of the second month in the second year. We make those comparisons because between Numbers 10 and Exodus 40, we have the book of Leviticus. What we find in the book of Leviticus was given to Israel over about a period of a month at the time when the tabernacle was finished and before they moved for the first time, which we see there in Numbers chapter 10. We find God's instruction to Israel in the book of Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is an easy book to just kind of ignore, isn't it? I mean, it starts out with all these details about sacrifices, and it's got all these regulations for sanitation and for various quarantines and hygiene. It's an easy book to just kind of brush past. But Leviticus is a book that teaches Israel how to worship God. Again, God is preparing his people to enter the land that he's going to give to them. In Exodus, he establishes his covenant with them and identifies them as his people. In Leviticus, he teaches his people how to worship him and how to relate to one another. The tabernacle has been completed. The first few chapters of Leviticus then detail the various offerings that are to be given at that tabernacle. He goes on to provide for them laws of cleanliness and hygiene and quarantine, chapters, say, 12 through 15, to help them be structured and organized as a people, to give them a structure for their society and to live in a way that will be healthy and safe. But we find some very important information in the book of Leviticus. Chapter 16 gives us details about how the Day of Atonement would be observed. And we find many parallels as we consider the Day of Atonement in our under the New Covenant. But God established the details of the observance of the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16. In, of course, Leviticus 23, he listed all the annual festivals, well, the weekly Sabbath too, and then all the annual festivals. How to worship God, when to worship God, what we're to learn. In chapters 18 and 19, we find a whole list of moral laws that emphasize how they should live to be a stable society. Laws against incest, homosexuality, reminders of specific commandments like the Sabbath and not stealing and not taking God's name in vain, learning to care for one another, love one another, love your neighbor as yourself. Those principles and instructions are all included in chapters 18 and 19. Chapter 26, Israel was warned of the consequences of disobeying God and the blessings that would come from obeying him. Chapter 27 introduces tithing, which is later given in more detail in the book of Numbers, but it's first introduced in Leviticus chapter 27. So the book of Leviticus contains detailed instructions about how to worship God as his people. The primary lesson of the book of Leviticus is given in chapter 11, verse 44. Leviticus 11, verse 44. I think it's interesting. We won't take time to elaborate, but it's interesting that God gave this summary statement about what is the purpose of this book that he's given to them in the same context as when he shows what are clean and unclean meats. Part of honoring God and worshiping him properly is to obey his commands that have to do with even the foods that we eat. But let's just look at in chapter 11, verse 44. It says, "For I am the Lord your God, you shall therefore consecrate yourselves. You shall be holy, for I am holy." God connects what we eat to how we relate to him. "Be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Verse 45, "For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." That's a summary statement of the lesson that we find in the book of Leviticus, to teach God's people how to be holy in the foods we eat, the days we observe, the way we live as a community. God is teaching them to be holy. So the parallel is obvious, isn't it? God is teaching us the same lessons. He's teaching us how to be his children, so that we'll be prepared when he brings us to our destination, his kingdom. Let's just look at a verse or two. 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. This book begins with a couple of the most encouraging passages in the Bible, verse 3 of 1 Peter 1. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation. It's a powerful and encouraging statement. God has set aside a place for us in his kingdom. It's reserved for us. It's a promise that never fades in spite of the circumstances in our lives. But there's some work that needs to be done so that we'll be prepared to be in that kingdom, to receive that promise that he is referring to. As you continue on through this chapter, verses 10 through 12, Peter describes how the Old Testament prophets spoke of Jesus Christ and the promises that he would fulfill, but they didn't really fully understand it because they were writing really for us, for those who would be part of that new covenant. Therefore, we begin in verse 13, therefore, Peter says, with this in mind, prepare your minds for action, would be the best way to phrase that. Gird up your loins, the loins of your mind. Prepare your mind for action. Mentally brace yourself and be ready for action. He said, goes on to say, be sober and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He's saying, think about it. Focus on it. Be sober and thoughtful about what the calling is we've received. Drop on down to verse 17, verse 16, I guess. I'm sorry, let's just go ahead and continue reading here. Verse 13, be sober and thoughtful about the revelation that's been revealed through Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming to the former lusts as in your ignorance. Now, see, this is a lesson that Israel never caught, did they? They continued in their former lusts and ignorance rather than learning from what God had begun teaching them. Verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. Just as God was teaching Israel how to be his nation, he's teaching us how to be his children. That we are to be holy as God is holy. The exact same lesson that he was teaching to the people of Israel. In fact, this is a quote from Leviticus 11, verse 45. And in quoting that, Peter is reminding us that our conduct must be holy. That we must be holy because God is holy. God has called us and delivered us, and we are to remember that and to not go back into a former way, as Israel was guilty of. God delivered us from oppression and slavery of sin, and he's teaching us to be his people. He's teaching us to be holy. The New Testament is filled with instruction about how to be holy, what our conduct must be, how to be his children, how to be his church, the kind of people he wants us to be. We have the words of Jesus Christ himself. We have the writings of Paul and the other apostles. God is teaching us those similar lessons that he taught to the people of Israel. And as their journey was not an easy one, neither is ours. Notice in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10. Knowing what we know about our destination, knowing about the promise God has given to us and the manner in which we are to live, to be holy in honor of our God who is holy, Peter writes near the end of his epistle, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10, may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. After God works in our lives to teach us the lessons that will prepare us to be his children, to prepare us to be a part of that destination of his kingdom, he will establish us. He will perfect us. He will strengthen us. He will settle us. There have been and there will be difficult things that will occur in our lives because we need to learn some lessons before we get to our destination. We kind of struggle sometimes to try to put it all together in our own terms so that we can understand it, so that it makes sense to us. But the point is that God is the one who is leading us through this life to that destination. Israel didn't choose to go into the desert, and neither do we. But they had to be prepared, and so do we. Romans chapter 8, just to kind of balance out the struggles that we are dealing with, this classic statement that Paul makes in Romans chapter 8, verse 18. Chapter 8, verse 18 is talking about the destination, about the outcome, about what the result is going to be of what God, of how God is working in our lives. Romans chapter 8, verse 18, Paul writes, I consider that the sufferings of this present time, the school we're going through right now, the wilderness that we are dealing with, the difficulties that God uses to teach us, the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Not worthy to be compared to the destination, what God is preparing for us. The destination is beyond comparison to the difficulty of the journey. There are so many lessons we can learn, maybe time to discuss one more. God was teaching Israel to trust him. God gave Israel opportunity to learn to trust him. Let's go back to Numbers 10 again. We looked at this a minute ago, Romans 10, Numbers 10, verse 11. Numbers chapter 10. We saw verse 11 here, where after they got to this 20th day of the second month in the second year, it says, then the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. In other words, after having been in that one location for about a year, now it was going to be time to move. The cloud lifted up from the tabernacle, and they began to move. So the journey of Israel started at that time. But as they started their journey, they immediately stumbled. Their first time to be on the move as a nation, to make progress toward their destination, they stumbled. They showed that they had not yet learned how to be God's people. They did not trust him. Chapter 10, verse 33 says, they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days. And the Ark of the Covenant went before them. Whenever I read that, I think of Gilligan's Island. They were on their way out for a 3-day tour, but they ran into more trouble than they thought. Verse chapter 11, verse 1, the people complained. The people complained. Now, it doesn't say why at this point they were complaining. Who knows? It was the first time, like I said, that they had picked up and moved from their location at Mount Sinai. I'm sure it was difficult. I'm sure it was they felt disorganized and a little chaotic because they weren't used to doing this. They weren't comfortable. Maybe they were hungry and thirsty again. They didn't know where they were going. They started complaining. They complained because God was sending them to a different place. Continue on, and there's another reason that they complained. The people cried out to Moses, verse 2. Okay, this is when God had punished them, and Moses prayed on their behalf, and he withheld the punishment at that time. Then verse 4, the mixed multitude who were among them yielded up to intense craving. So the children of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" So this time their complaint is more specific. Now they want some meat. They're sick and tired of manna. Every day, manna. They get up in the morning, there it is, manna. Well, it kept them going. I feel a little bit that way about oatmeal. Every morning, it's oatmeal. But it's healthy, I suppose. At least I get some meat when I get to lunch. But they were craving something besides what God had given to them. They were complaining. Complaining is a way of expressing doubt. It's a symptom of a lack of faith. It's obviously a symptom of not being thankful, of not trusting God to provide what we really need. We're not satisfied with what we have. God was displeased with them, and you continue on through the next few verses, and you'll see that Moses was at his wit's end with these people. He didn't know what to do with them. He was saying, "God, these aren't my people. Why do I have to deal with all their complaints and their demands?" You know, it's a good thing that Moses didn't realize at that point that this would be continuing for another 38 years. But the people didn't learn to trust God. Of course, from this point, they continued. And if you piece this together, it was about 12 to 13 months after they left Egypt, when they began to move here from, here in Numbers 10, and they started moving toward their entrance to Palestine or to Canaan, and took another couple of months. So really the first time they came to the land of Canaan and had the opportunity to enter was about 15 or so months, maybe 16 months after they had left Egypt. And they came to they had the opportunity at that point. Now, that's a long enough journey as it is. But during that time, God had given them the instruction. God had given them, performed some miracles for them. He'd provided for them. He'd cared for them. He'd given them, shown them how to be his people, how to live up to the covenant. They should have been prepared at that point to enter the land. And God was ready to bring them into it at that point. But they balked. Chapter 14 says, verse 1, all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses. Would have been better if we died in Egypt than to come here to be slaughtered by these people in the land. And so they turned their back on God. They didn't trust him. They refused to take the promise that God had made. They'd reached their destination, but they wouldn't go in. God is teaching us to trust him. God is teaching us to trust him. The circumstances that we have, and we've mentioned that we have difficulties, we have trials, we have events that take place that we don't know what to make of, that are almost overwhelmingly difficult. God isn't just arbitrarily beating up on us. God is teaching us to trust him. Let's compare this to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews, the third chapter. There's really a lengthy section here. We'll try to go through it quickly. That relates to what Israel went through. Hebrews chapter 3. Beginning of verse 17. I'm sorry, verse 7, beginning of verse 7. This is a quote actually from Psalm 95. It says, "Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion in the day of trial in the wilderness when your fathers tested me and tried me." This is relating to the time when they refused to go into the land of Canaan in the first place. And they saw my works for 40 years. They were then confined or sentenced to 40 years in the wilderness because they balked at going into the land that God had given to them. Verse 12, therefore, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. That's the lesson for us to learn from Israel's experience. Don't have a heart of unbelief, in other words, a lack of faith, not being willing to trust God. It's called an evil heart because it is in defiance of God's promises and of what God has done in our lives. To doubt him is to give in to evil thoughts. God's eyes, they're evil because of the doubt and because of the unwillingness to accept and believe in the living God. But exhort one another daily while it's called today, lest any of you should be hardened against the deceitfulness, through the deceitfulness of sin. So we're called upon as a church, as a group, together, to remind each other, to encourage one another, to continue in faith and not to fall by the wayside. Sometimes people wonder, what's the point? Why should we have prayer requests? Why do we pray for one another? Is God waiting on his throne for, and okay, if I get two more prayers, then I'm going to intervene for this person. And he's counting the prayers. What's the purpose of us praying for one another? Part of it, at least, is what is shown here in this verse, that we encourage one another daily to continue in the faith. We support one another. We go to God's throne on behalf of one another. We show our love and concern and compassion for each other. And even as Mr. Grimm mentioned in the card that I read, that we are encouraged, strengthened by one another. And we provide comfort through our support. So we learn to look to God and not to be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ. Okay, we've partaken the promises and blessings that we see in the Passover and in Christ's intervention on our behalf if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. Israel had a lot of confidence the night they left Egypt. They left with a mighty hand. They left strongly emboldened by what they were experiencing, but they didn't hold that confidence. They were not steadfast in it. Verse 15, while it is said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Don't harden. Don't turn away from God. Don't mistrust him after all that he's done for us and that we've experienced, that we've seen in our lives. While we're in Hebrews, let's just remember a verse that we usually associate with the fall holy days. But I think it's just as appropriate to consider at this time of year in chapter 11, verse 13. Because we're learning to trust God and learning to look to him, as is described here in this passage, the summary passage in the chapter on faith. Chapter 11, verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. God is leading us the long way around. And chances are it'll happen to us just like it happened to Abraham and to those that are described here in this chapter, that we will live our entire life looking ahead to the promises. And they may not be fulfilled in this lifetime. They died in faith. They died trusting God. Not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, they were assured of them, they embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in the land. We, as they did, declare plainly that we seek a destination, We seek a homeland. We seek what God is promising to us. And when the journey gets difficult, and it does, we need to remember the hope and the promise and the certainty of our destination. So here's the point I'm trying to make today. God chose a path for Israel to lead them to their promised land, their destination. Along the way, he prepared them to be his people. But they complained, they doubted, they rebelled from the beginning, and they never really got the point. They didn't realize what it meant to be God's people. God has chosen a path for us. He's chosen a path that will lead us to the promise of his kingdom. No, it's not easy. God isn't taking us down the interstate to the first exit. In fact, there are times when it seems like we might be going in the opposite direction. There may not seem to be any path at all. But as we continue along the way, with God leading us through this journey, we're learning the lessons that we need to be prepared to be God's family, to be prepared to reach the promises, receive the promises that God has given to us. And we should always be reminded and be thankful that our life is a journey to a destination.